Hello, my name is Claire Armistead. I'm the literary editor of The Guardian, and one of my tasks during the year is to longlist and oversee the Guardian First Book Prize. And in the run-up to the prize, which is awarded shortly, interviewing each of the shortlisted contestants. And this week's turn is Rosemary Hill, whose book about the Victorian architect Pugin is one of four in the running. Rosemary, welcome. You're going to start with a little extract from the book to set the scene for us.
To see Pugin steadily means to see him whole and in his time. He himself never admitted any distinction between his work and his life, any more than between his faith and his art. His importance was, as his contemporaries said, that he inspired, transformed, and reinvigorated English architecture and design. To see him only as an architect, or as a writer, or as a Catholic, will always produce a baffling and partial view. At the turn of another century, it is easier, perhaps, to put Pugin together again, to sympathise with what he felt and wanted. The confidence of our post-war town planners has long since evaporated. We feel once more that there is something wrong with our cities, and that perhaps this has something to do with ourselves. 50 years ago, the association of religion with art and politics seemed peculiarly Victorian. But the God question does not go away, and a new millennium poses it again. The passage of time hasn't made Pugin's bad buildings any better, but it has yielded a fuller appreciation of the best and revealed new qualities of insight and daring in buildings that were little considered in the 19th century, obscure village schools, country parsonages, and unrealised designs for churches. His work contains, like a densely packed capsule, almost everything that followed, with the High Victorians, the arts and crafts movement, and in the works of Morris and Ruskin. Working in every medium, in glass and metal and stone, and as a pattern designer of Mozartian facility, it would take three generations to develop all that was implicit in Pugin's short career. Pugin's story begins with his parents. He lived with them for half his life, and their deaths propelled him into the central crisis of his life. His father, Auguste Charles, was a French émigré, the soi-disant Comte de Pugin. When Kenneth Clarke wrote the Gothic Revival, it was A.C. Pugin, the artist of the microcosm of London, who was better remembered than his son. Pugin's early work grew seamlessly out of his father's, while his clever, caustic mother, Catherine Welby, largely shaped his peculiar cast of mind. It was she who gave him the idea for Contrasts, his first important book. Catherine and Auguste Pugin were Georgians, born before the French Revolution and already in their 40s in 1812. They belonged to a different age from that in which their son reached adulthood. From the England of Miss Austen, Froude wrote soon after Pugin's death, to the England of railways and free trade, how vast the change. The world moves faster and faster. The temper of each new generation is a continual surprise. It was essential to Pugin's character and to his place in history that he belonged as much to the England of Jane Austen as to the Victorian age. He articulated, and in part he brought about, the change of temper from one to the other. That gave him his importance and his success. It accounted also for the bitterness of his last years. Formed by the Georgian age, he violently rejected. He was never wholly at ease with the Victorian ethos he helped to form. In one of Pugin's sketchbooks, there is a note written by his widow Jane in 1867. She was 40 then and had been widowed for 15 years. Her marriage, the most vivid experience of her life, had lasted 4. Who has used this pencil? Old Mr. Pugin and Augustus, at least 40 years old. And here I am, writing on the sofa in my room, on Monday, April the 27th, 1867. Kate is singing in the attic, I dreamt I dwelt in marble halls. Mary and Peter in the library. I do not feel well, I do not think I shall long be here. I have nothing to live for. It is a scene from Dickens or Millet. The still handsome but melancholy widow repining on the sofa. The parlour ballad floating down the stairs. Outside, beyond the heavy curtains, the rattle of railways and free trade is audible. Turning the pages of the same sketchbook, we are suddenly in the England of Miss Austen, among old Mr. Pugin's drawings of the trial of Queen Caroline. Pugin's biography begins there, with his father, Auguste Charles, who first picked up his pencil in Paris before the revolution.
I think that gives an impression of how vividly imagined this biography is, although it's also very carefully sourced. You haven't sort of put dialogue into their mouths or anything.
No, I wouldn't do that. I mean, thousands and thousands of Pugin's own letters survive, so one has a very strong sense of his voice. On the other hand, he actually famously destroyed all the letters he received as soon as he answered them, so other voices are missing. And it is a question of knitting together what you have and trying to leave suggestive gaps. But no, I don't. I wouldn't have felt at all happy about putting words into their mouth.
And you have this sense of the England that, and also of the legacy of the French Revolution as well, that's come into the country, which I found absolutely fascinating.
Well, I must say, I found researching Pugin's father, this slightly fraudulent French refugee, absolutely fascinating. And he was, as I said, he was a famous artist in his own right. But that tremendous upheaval that there was on the continent, the combination of Europe in chaos and England really rather isolated, it was a world in which someone like Auguste Pugin could arrive and say more or less anything about themselves. And of course, it changed everybody's mind about everything. And we tend to think of the French Revolution as being, in its effects, in its short-term effects, over by the turn of the 19th century, and not to think of the early Victorians being still traumatised by it, as they were. I mean, a lot of people, really very serious people, believed that it was the beginning of the millennium. It was the first time that people had seen a whole system of government overthrown.
And then in he comes to this world of Pugin's mother, who which is a sort of Islington. She's bookish, isn't she, and independent and...
Yes.
Very modern, really.
Oh, very modern. I mean, Catherine Welby, Pugin's mother's correspondent, survives in Yale in the British Arts Centre. And when I found it there, I was absolutely entranced because a lot of her letters survive. And you see her growing from her late teens, great enthusiasm for various books, always the latest thing, the latest intellectual thing. She was a campaigning vegetarian. She was into pantisocracy, which meant communal living, to try and establish a new morality for a new age. And you watch her, as I say, grow up and go through all these various intellectual phases one after another with tremendous enthusiasm.
And part of the reason for talking about Pugin's parents, although this is of course a book about Pugin and not his parents, is to try and get a sense of how precocious he must have been.
Well, I mean that people have different views about writing about childhoods in biography. Some people love them, some people don't. I think it just depends on the child. And if you're dealing with somebody who at the age of 15 was working for the king at Windsor Castle, then you're dealing with someone whose childhood is pretty extraordinary and whose parents are probably pretty important. So that was my hunch when I started. And, of course, as soon as I started to research them, I realised how important they were.
And at nine, he was going off, taking himself off on tours of Europe, wasn't he?
Yes, well, not all by himself at the age of nine. He was with his parents. But he was very early on able to organise things for himself. I mean, people who were interested in architecture in those days, we were interested in medieval architecture, because medieval architecture wasn't thought anything of. It was very easy to go into a medieval church or a cathedral, and if you wanted to knock a hole in the ceiling to see how it was constructed or something like that, you could just do it. And Pugin, very early on, not quite at nine, but very soon after that, following in his father's footsteps, was going to Rochester Castle and digging out the foundations. And he knew at that age already how to go somewhere, how to hire a couple of workmen and say, you know, I want a trench dug down there and bring me everything you find.
And he was always knew that it was the Gothic and medieval buildings that he was interested in. He didn't have much truck with the Renaissance, did he?
We didn't know anything about the Renaissance. I mean, that was the thing about growing up. I mean, he never went to school properly, and he only learned what his parents could teach him. And his father, of course, made him bilingual, taught him a lot about medieval architecture. His mother instilled in him a profound dislike, really, of evangelical religion. But she, I think, from her, he inherited a very religious temperament. But he never went to school formally, so he didn't know anything about the Renaissance. He only really knew about modern architecture, which in the 1820s and 30s, when he was growing up, was pretty flimsy and becoming really rather run down. And he knew about Gothic architecture, which, of course, was beautiful but very neglected.
Mm. And we talk about him as one of our greatest architects, but he wasn't very satisfied with his work, was he?
No. I mean, I couldn't, when I started, one of the reasons I decided that biography was the way to get at Pugin was because he undoubtedly is very important. But when you go and look at quite a lot of his buildings, there is no way of getting around the fact that they're just not very good. A lot of them have suffered very badly. But and I thought, well, how am I going to sort of find out why this is? In one sense, the answer is a very simple one, which is that he built most when he knew least. And he did have no training as an architect. And however precocious you are, if you have absolutely no training and you design a cathedral at the age of 22, it's not going to be perfect. And he learned by his mistakes, and he made a lot of mistakes, and things fell down and they weren't in the right place. And the real sadness of Pugin's life is that by the time he got to the point where he really knew exactly what he was doing and how to achieve, I mean, he started off like a lot of architects, I think, by just trying to build his drawings. But once he really was thinking in three dimensions and knew how to use materials and so on, his practice was already in decline. And then, of course, he died very young. I think had he lived longer, his practice would have recovered. And
he was 40, wasn't he, when
he died? He was 40 when he died.
It's unbelievable that he lived such a short time.
Extraordinary. And, I mean, I think even to his contemporaries, we all think of, oh, these phenomenal Victorians, and they were phenomenal. But even to contemporaries, Pugin seemed to be living almost like a speeded-up film.
And he had been mad for a while before he died, hadn't he?
Yes. I mean, I think it was another one of the aspects of the biography that was very interesting, but you have to be very careful with retrospective diagnosis. But I think he was somebody who had what we would now call manic episodes, and I suspect that his mother had had them too. But that was nothing to do with his final illness. And insofar as it's possible to tell what he finally died of, it seems most likely he died of syphilis. But for the last few months of his life, he was insane, he was psychotic, except for the last few days, of which his last wife kept a very poignant diary, when he did become rational again, just for a few last days.
Now, the building that most people would know that he did was associated with were the Houses of Parliament. Can you tell us a little bit about that and his involvement?
Well, it's another of the many ironies of Pugin's life that, of course, the most famous work is, as you say, the Palace of Westminster. And it was the thing that he really was least interested in. It was something that he did. He went, because Pugin had this extraordinary command of Gothic detail from a very young age, at a time when most architects, I mean, architects trained in offices or they went to Greece or Rome, hadn't the faintest idea how to build a Gothic building. When Gothic became fashionable, Pugin was very much in demand as a draftsman, and he drew the competition entry for Charles Barry when the old Palace of Westminster burned down. Barry was one of those who competed to do the new one. In fact, Pugin did the drawings for two of the entries, and Barry's won. So then he had no more to do with it until it came to finishing the interior of the building. And Barry was a classic, very good architect, but a classical architect, needed Pugin to do all the furnishing, all the tiles, the stained glass, the metalwork, the woodwork. Nobody except Pugin, nobody in the world could have done that. But of course, Pugin didn't particularly want to do it, because by then he was no longer a young, obscure draftsman. He was a very busy and famous architect. But Barry twisted his arm. Pugin was oddly amenable. He very rarely turned a friend down for anything. And so he agreed to do it, and it became this terrible treadmill. And he had no proper job title other than superintendent of woodcarving.
I love that, superintendent of woodcarving.
Well, it was a typical sort of own goal by Pugin, really, because he didn't want to do what Barry had to do, which was to go endlessly to meetings and explain himself to committees. Pugin couldn't bear that kind of thing. So he said, look, you just front it all, I'll do it, but you have to do all the front work. And that meant, of course, that Barry wasn't obliged to give Pugin any credit, and indeed he didn't.
Oh, dear, dear, dear. He used to work 16 hours a day, absolute workaholic, but he also had eight children and several wives.
Yes.
And there is a sort of, I get a feeling from the book, of a great affection that you have for him.
Yes. I mean, I've, as it were, lived with Pugin for a very long time. And I think, although, of course, there are times when you think, oh, for God's sake, when you're reading someone's letters, I can see how this is going to turn out. And it does. It all goes horribly wrong. He was someone with almost no insight, but also someone who was very honest. And in all those thousands of letters, you never catch him saying one thing to one person and then a rather snidey thing to somebody else about them. And so I think that makes him very lovable. There was, as you say, I mean, everything, family life, home life, work life, everything was at full tilt. I think because when he was 20 and 21 in that year, he lost both his parents and his first wife in childbirth. And it was such a most terrible crisis. And after that, he added a motto to his slightly bogus coat of arms, en avant. And I think he never could bear to think about the past. I think he sort of hurtled forward through life, trying to cram in as much as possible.
He also had a great sort of self-effacing streak, didn't he? I love that line about that he said the only letters he'd ever have after his name was very pointy.
VP for very pointed. Well, he was never going to fit in with any kind of institution. I mean, he was the first and one of the very few people, I think, ever to practice architecture as a romantic art. I mean, he behaved as a poet might. You know, it was his creation. He worked totally alone. And every institution he had anything to do with, from the Royal Academy to the Vatican, he fell foul of. He could never fit in.
So now this book is, when I first told people, I was canvassing people to review it, they were all saying, the long-awaited. It has been long-awaited.
Yeah, it has been long-awaited.
So how did you first get interested in Pugin?
Well, I'd always been interested in Morris and Ruskin. What really interested me was this rather curious thing of how you get abstract philosophical ideas into three-dimensional objects. Sounds odd, but I mean, it's very easy, if you have an idea about the human condition, it's very easy to express it directly in a poem or a painting. But why, if you have a particular philosophical understanding of the world, you should decide that furniture ought to look a certain way or wallpaper ought to be a certain way. It seems very odd, and yet people have always done it, and in England particularly, Ruskin had views like that, Morris had views like that, and I was always interested in them. And then I became increasingly aware of this person behind them chronologically, and also behind them in the sense that he was much less known and talked about, who was Pugin.
And so will it be another architect next?
No.
what's going to come next after this big book?
Well, at the moment I'm writing, it's much easier, I've decided to write a small book on a large subject than a large book on a relatively small subject of one life. So I'm now writing a short book on the history of Stonehenge.
Which is published next year?
Which is to be published next year, yes, by Profile.
Great. Very good. God's Architect by Rosemary Hill is published by Allen Lane, and very good luck with the prize. Thank you.